Seattle, Washington, October 17, 1979. This is side one of the first of two tapes, an interview with Professor Martin Duffy and Christine Miller, research analyst for the University of Minnesota Labor Education Service, concerning the Minneapolis General Driver Strike of 1934.
Hello.
Hello, Mr. Malloy.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
Very well. How are you?
Fine.
Well, good. Thank you for your envelope filled with good articles that
yeah.
you sent the other day. I passed around one of them to some of the other people in the office.
Which one was that?
About the three-piece...
That come out of the Dispatcher Union paper.
Uh-huh.
But it was not written by our people. It was written by someone else, Rain Millers or somebody.
Uh-huh.
But it was a good article.
Yeah, I thought it was, too. Some people in here are interested in that, the new sophisticated union-busting tactics, and, are collecting articles, and I thought that they might be interested in that one, so I
Oh, certainly.
Them.
I'll send you another one. The Northwest Airlines, which is based in Minneapolis,
right.
had a major strike in 1972. They seem to have a strike every time it's contract time.
Uh-huh.
And, three or four of the pilots broke ranks, returned to work, and were subsequently expelled from the union, but not removed from their jobs.
Uh-huh.
And they're making a test case now of it. It's
mm-hmm.
7 years. And the people that are behind it is this Fairfax, Virginia outfit, so I'll send you that. The case has not been decided. It came on for argument the other day.
Uh-huh. Well, that sounds interesting. Yeah,
it connects this whole thing, you know. And I'll try to dig out the reprint from the Teamster magazine of a couple of years back when they were first taking after Coors, and they identified this new right with Vigory and this whole group, you know.
Uh-huh.
And we have a local personage here by the name of Gottlieb.
Uh-huh.
And he conducts some sort of a very, very super, super mailing for the right wing, and he collects millions of dollars. For these, the group of people that surrounded Hitler is my way I view it. Of course, I ain't too learned on world history, but I can remember that because I lived through it.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, that's quite something. It's very frightening, too, to
it is frightening.
Understand just how well organized this powerful right wing is and how much money they do have.
Mm-hmm.
They've really acquired, I don't know if it's that they have acquired a broad base of support, or if it's more that they've just gotten support from the people who can do something.
Well, I think all your points are valid, but I also like to inject the fact that perhaps for a while many employers were reluctant to take unions on because they were feasting at the pork barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And now when they got back on their own and private enterprise and they can't, well, there's still a few of them that are still scooping up the money, Tenneco. Incidentally, they agreed to recognize the union. That's that big steelworks in Virginia.
Uh-huh.
But you see McDonnell Douglas and a few more,
mm-hmm.
and that are being subsidized by the government,
mm-hmm.
by you and I, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they're getting a little more courage to speak out on their own. They're certainly imbued with all the world power that they can get from any place, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that idiot statement that the commander-in-chief of the American Armed Forces said yesterday, he's going to lay down the law to Castro because Castro's got people in other countries in Cuba. I don't think there's a country in the world that we haven't got an armed base in except the Soviet Union and China.
Yeah, but that's not supposed to count. That's
no, 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 no.
To be there, right?
Don't do as I do as I say. I sent you the little poem. Did you get that, by the way?
Yeah,
I think I put
did.
It in.
Thank you very much. I should tell you, I have it taped to my desk. So I can see it right
yeah,
there.
Persevere, that's the word.
Yeah.
Well, where do we want to start now?
Let's see. I've got my list right here.
Mm-hmm.
I think we ended with question 45 about Cliff Hall.
Yeah.
And the next question asks about several people who participated in the strike, but I think that... Given what, with the conversation, what it was last week, or last time, perhaps we ought to skip that one and come back to it later.
Very well. Where would you care to go then?
How about if we talk specifically about what ended the strike and what you remember about the provisions of the agreement?
Well, now, what ended the strike?
I know that's kind of a big question, isn't it?
Of course, just in sum, we'd have to say that what ended the strike, of course, was, of course, I'm a little partial, you understand. I'm from the union side.
Okay.
It was the indomitable fight that the union had carried out to the end that they had stymied the employer practically at every turn of the road in spite of all the bad days we had.
Uh-huh.
And of course, when everything failed, of course, the whole, I have to philosophize here a minute if I use the word right. It seems that every time that there's been a major conflict in the workers and the employers in America, they've relied upon the constabulary and the troops and whatever to bust up the strikes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because of the sagacity of certain of the leaders in 574, this didn't come to pass, notwithstanding the brilliance of Governor Olson.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, a kind of an ironical thing that while many of the local bigwigs in the labor movement, or personages, if you want to call them, if they weren't bigwigs,
mm-hmm.
at least they thought they were, they were so careful to preserve the image of the Farm Labor Party, and they were willing to go all carte blanche for anything that Floyd told them. He was smarter than they. He knew that he couldn't break the strike. And he had to get on a position that he won, but not in the role of breaking the strike. And he couldn't find a way out.
Mm-hmm.
Ray and Scogie and Farrell and Mickey and Grant and Bill, those guys, they were just too much for him. And, of course, they weren't, who was it in Cinderella that touched the wand and everything become wonderful?
Mm-hmm.
The times, the events that had led up to the complete degradation of the American citizen with that tremendous and horrendous debacle, the stock market, and the loss of dignity, I think all of those things all come to bear in the middle of August. Because without the support of the people in Minneapolis, without the support of the unorganized workers, without the support of the many of the people who were not what you call every day-to-day laborer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the blue-collar group. Many, many, many of them supported the union. Maybe not just the union per se, but certainly what the union stood for.
Mm-hmm.
They may not have been ready to come down there and you know, volunteer to carry a book in the union and go to work on the docks. But they certainly believed that the American people were entitled to what the Constitution of the United States afforded them. There were some of them that took it on a Simon Pure basis, too. There was others that had their different points of view. But all of them welded together, created an atmosphere that was helpful in winning the strike. Now, as I summed up, there was many things, internal and external problems in our last conversation with you that was in the last days of the strike, weren't troublesome, but they were items that had to be dealt with. Well, the employers had gone to court. They were putting the pressure on Olson. Some of the employers in their ranks were threatening to sign agreements. I think two or three of them did. It was starting to be a little few leaks in the dike from the employer side. And the thing was getting kind of tough. Now, there was another thing that was happening, and of course, I didn't probably realize it, like I've had a chance to analyze it since. But President Roosevelt couldn't let this thing continue. And he had sent in a group to settle the longshore strike on the West Coast, the maritime, the longshoremen and the seamen. And he didn't want the country to be faced with, and there was certainly a lot of publicity. Graham McNamee, he was one of the newscasters, you know, that's how people got their news. Mm-hmm. Used to go to the movie theaters, and they'd have these two or three newsreels. And I think as many people went there to get the news as they did some of that garbage they offered them under the guise of entertainment. Mm-hmm. And that guy, Floyd Gibbons, with the patch over his eye, and a few more, they were all, you know, muckrakers, and they were yakking away. And Roosevelt had a myth that he was trying to hoist off on the American people, too, you know. And he wanted confidence for bigger things to come, I guess. But anyway, he took a learn in it, because first, the federal mediators were under the direction, indirectly at least, if not directly, Omar Perkins. She was the Secretary of Labor. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, they had a responsibility, if you're going to look into the obligation of that post in the cabinet. And, of course, you know, the hired hand doesn't do much until they talk to the boss. So she must have talked to Roosevelt.
That's true, she did.
And it seems to me in our earlier discussions you had made, or one of our discussions, that you had made a journey into Washington, and you were perhaps privy to some of their notes or memorandums, or I don't think they had tapes, you know.
Well, you're absolutely right. There was definitely a great deal of concern about the Minneapolis strike on the part of the folks over in Washington, including the president and including the Secretary of Labor. I'm interested in what you were saying about FDR's need to end the strike. Do you think he perhaps would have not cared so much if it went on longer had there not been the longshore strike out in San Francisco and the Toledo Autolite strike going on? Do you think he might have wanted to use this Minneapolis strike as an example of what ought not to happen, and by letting the ramifications be what they might be, or?
I don't think that he had anything but one thing in mind. And I think that he was out to hoodwink the American people. And he too was not a dummy.
In what way in particular was he trying to hoodwink?
Well, see, my considered opinion is that when Roosevelt took office, the country was on the verge of a social revolution. They couldn't have gone much farther down the line. Any person that stood around and was abused the way that the people were in the United States, that were not getting enough to eat, getting evicted from their homes, no work. It was a terrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you certainly have access there to the Minneapolis papers and the food riots, the demonstrations against the central issuing of welfare orders, all the social things that go to make up a person's life, no medical care, lining up at that atrocious city hospital, walking down to the hospital. Can you imagine a mother in the middle of night having a child that was ill, no automobile, trying to get an ambulance to take her child out down to the hospital, or she trying to go there, and go through that terrible routine that they used to go through, treating them. Boy, farmers treated a mare that was going to have a foal or a cow that was going to calve with much more consideration than the American mothers were treated during that period of time. And that's just one incident. Other things, someone is ill, being evicted from their homes, no fuel. That Highbinder preacher there, that Mecklenburg, you've probably read about the scheme he had there where he had a whole bunch of people working for script.
Yes, I recall that.
And chopping wood. And if you work so many hours out chopping wood, you were entitled to a half a cord if you could find a way to haul it. Nobody had pickup trucks then.
Uh-huh.
And people picking coal off the railroad tracks and stealing things in order to just keep from freezing. Minneapolis, you know, it gets kind of severe in the wintertime sometimes.
Sure.
All of these kind of things, Roosevelt stepped in at the end of the Hoover administration, and he was preaching the New Deal. Well, by God, he had to do something to make it stick. He wanted to be, I suppose, in my opinion of him, in the eyes of the American working people, and I'm not pro-Resolution, Rooseveltian, I mean. He, in his long-range projection, I'm not so naive as to believe. I didn't understand it clear at that time, but I did learn to appraise it. I'm not so naive as to believe that Roosevelt at any time didn't watch the ascension of Hitler, what was going on, without an idea that somewhere along the line, America and fascism might go hand in hand, or they might have to fight one another to settle who's going to rule the show. And, of course, they had the scepter over there of our friend with the mustache, Joe Stalin.
Mm-hmm.
And these things were, I think, well thought out by Roosevelt and his policy-making people. Old Bernard Baruch with the high-button shoes that he used to sit on the bench in the parks with. And the Business Advisory Council, which is now Camp David, they were all in the act, and I'm convinced that they felt, well, we don't want a little pesky bunch of drivers in Minneapolis raising hell. We don't want a bunch of sailors and longshoremen on the West Coast raising hell. We don't want the Toledo Autolite strikers. I don't think Roosevelt interfered too much in the Toledo Autolite strike, as he did. That was more local constabulary, if I remember that right, the Ohio National Guard. But I don't think Roosevelt wanted a continuation.
So,
because remember, the textile workers were on the march too that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he could see all sorts of items that if they ever got together and banded on one common cause might even unseat him.
Mm-hmm.
So these are speculations on my part, but they're from what I've read and understood, and I've watched this terrible thing of war, I'm convinced that Roosevelt knew what was going on. So he wanted to end it.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that that Roosevelt, in fact, feared the threat of fascism and that it might arise here in the United States because of how bad conditions were here unless something was done to quash the anger of the...
Well, I didn't quite get the way you posed that first part of the question. I didn't hear you too well.
Okay, you said that that I think that what you were saying, and you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, that Roosevelt feared the threat of fascism.
No, I didn't mean it that way.
No, you didn't.
I think he was an advocate of fascism, and fascism is a force of armed rule. And I think that he was not above utilizing that. Fascism is the last resort, in my opinion, of capitalism. When you can't rule anymore with this malarkey that you've got democracy, mm-hmm. and that you're entitled to get out of the Constitution what the Constitution or the Bill of Rights says, then you have to do exactly like Hitler does. Get the stormtroopers in and push it down their throat. But he didn't want the image of bringing fascism out.
Uh-huh.
There's no doubt in my mind that the way they handled the Pullman strike and the Haymarket massacre and the Homestead strike, that they couldn't have done the same thing in Minneapolis. Nothing at all, and I think that's what the Minneapolis employers were after. And that's why they were putting the heat on Roosevelt. I mean on Olson. And they were not satisfied with what Olson was doing.
Why then did Roosevelt, or the American Congress at that time, institute so many social reforms?
Well, did he have any other way to go?
Well, what about absolute fascism at that point? I mean, total and absolute fascism.
Well, generally speaking, I'm not too much of a hunter, but I know if you're going to catch anything, you always bait the trap. And there were certain social reforms that came during the Roosevelt administration that would have come probably in more radical sense if Hoover would have remained. He was trying to appease, in my opinion, what was becoming the wrath of the American worker. I don't think that Roosevelt was for all the things that happened, but he knew that if he didn't do something, he might not be able to do anything. People can rise up. There's been all sorts of demonstrations where people rising up. I'll just take the most recent one down in Nicaragua. Look at the years and the terrible persecutions that those people did, and they finally had enough of it. And a new form of government could be instituted. And I think Roosevelt was smart enough to see that. If he wasn't, certainly his advisors were. And we had to keep the ranks quiet. And they couldn't have. It would be hard, I suppose. Of course, I can't speak for Roosevelt. But I suppose it would have been hard to equate, on the one hand, that and I remember all the things that Roosevelt said he was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have, I think he had more intelligence than Carter. But a lot of people remembered what he said. And he couldn't very well say, well, I'm for this, fellas, and then start right out and do it altogether different. And we'll just take Carter. And I just, by chance, went through some of my old papers here and come across the 1976 edition of the Scanner, which is the voice of the Federation of Labor here, and all, you wouldn't believe they're the same people that are talking about what a great guy Carter was. Well, now it's Kennedy. Well, 4 years from now it'll be Joe Dokes. But I think that Roosevelt himself was savvy enough to know that if you used the big stick too much, it might boomerang. Now, there were some social gains made, but were they made because Roosevelt made them, or was it that he was mindful of the pulse of the people? You know, he'd done some things. He changed the Supreme Court, all of that, and that all went with the theory of the New Deal and the fireside chattel. That was a big deal, you know. He won a lot of people with them fireside chats. He got us all ready to goose-step there in 1941. There was no child at all to get us into the war. We were going to capture the world. So I believe that...
Did you feel this way about him during that time? Or
what?
Did you feel as strongly about him at the time, or have these feelings increased over the years?
They weren't as clear in my mind in 1934 as they are today, because I didn't have the laboratory to work it out in. But since 1934, and in the big fights to keep America out of war in 35 and 36 and Roosevelt's second term for office, I was aware of which way I thought Roosevelt was going. And I certainly, over the years, like anything else, you know, as the years go along, you mellow on certain things. But looking back, of course, you want to remember I had the advantage of listening to Carl Skoglund and Ray Dunn, and in part Dobbs, and my stepdad, and beyond that, what I'd observed bouncing around the country. And then when the big fights come on, when Hitler was really on the march, that's what started me really to try to count up, the marbles. And it was a frightening thing to see the heads of various governments running around paying homage to Hitler. I was convinced early that there was something terrible going on. Of course, over the years where I've seen, I went through that war and I saw the terrible destruction of people. I spent the summer of 1942 in the Soviet Union. I watched the soldiers march. I was up there when they were escaping out of Leningrad. I observed the war in its very worst. And of course, I've become more, not bitter, but more incensed about it since that time. Anyone, no one in their right mind can look for war, you know. You just can't do it.
Good.
If anyone thinks that the answer to all of this is war, then those are the dangerous people we have to watch. And you see more and more the playbacks of the Hitler rise to power and what it was done on. You know, the world at war is being shown here on the TVs, and it brings back some horrible memories to you.
Oh, it does. Well, in Roosevelt's response to the strike, then you see mainly his interest in preserving a control over the direction that the citizenry might have gone.
Well, I believe this. I don't know if I understand exactly what you pose there, but I suppose Roosevelt, it wasn't the thing that Roosevelt got up and ate with his breakfast, you know, with his grapefruit in the morning, if he ate grapefruit. And he didn't talk it over with Fowler, probably, there when he first got out of bed. But I'm sure that during the course of the day, his cabinet officers advised him what was going on. His job was, too, just immense for him to keep track of everything by himself. And Ma Perkins played quite a role with President Roosevelt during that time. And I suppose she advised him what was going on, and, of course, 5,000-6,000 truck drivers in Minneapolis were not going to turn the tide back, you know. We weren't King Canute or nothing like that. And we weren't going to try. But it was an embarrassing thing for Roosevelt to have these things go on week after week.
And he was at this new program he had instituted with the labor board, the regional and national.
Right, could fall apart.
Was just going to...
as a fraud and a sham. And certain people understood it. I grabbed it right quick.
So you think that his interest was mainly political?
Of course.
Okay.
And what the hell, we'll deal with this union like we've dealt with other unions.
Uh-huh.
In 1921, we broke the unions. That ain't no big thing. They've got them house broke again today. They're running around looking for some Democrat that they can get in their pocket, doesn't hope that they'll get something out of Congress.
Uh-huh.
And so I believe that his interest was not at all about the salvation of the Minneapolis truck driver or his better conditions.
Uh-huh.
He just was going to maintain his image, and he didn't want the people to say, well, this guy, we've got another highbinder.
Uh-huh.
He's going to come in here and do right, and he does wrong. What he told us don't count. That's what I believe.
So what would you imagine his instructions to the the National Labor Board people who served on this strike and the Regional Labor Board people?
Well, I wouldn't speculate what his instructions were. But what the record shows, at first, he sent in Dunnigan. Mm-hmm. Dunnigan couldn't do the job. Next, he sent in Father Haas. Haas and Dunnigan got together, and they couldn't do the job with the help of the governor. And Olson, of course, I don't suppose was accepted with complete honesty by Roosevelt either, because he was not a Democrat. So when that failed, Roosevelt then sent in Donahue. And that was the pattern that Roosevelt used in the maritime strike on the West Coast. He sent in that panel of arbitrators. Mm-hmm. He sent in Donahue to wind the strike up. And Donahue must have had some orders from somebody, because he did prevail upon the Citizens Alliance to change their line. I'm sure of that. They hadn't changed, you know. See, they were going to homestead strike this thing out. They were going to bring in the thugs, perhaps. Because they certainly had a method. When they went into court to get an injunction against martial law, what did they intend to put in its place? Again, I say, I can't speculate what they had in mind. But my sense of direction and my compass directions would indicate to me that they intended to have their private armies do the work that the National Guard couldn't do.
But, okay, clearly then what resulted in from the strike was some new power for the Union, power that they did not yet, they hadn't up until that point had.
Well,
do you think this was foreseen by the government?
I don't follow your question there.
Well, Minneapolis was no longer an open shop town once the Minneapolis truckers won their struggle.
Oh, I don't think that's a fair appraisal.
No?
Oh, no, no. We had some big fights. Minneapolis turned the tide, all right. The settling of the strike in victory for the Union set the pace.
Uh-huh.
But the period that followed, Minneapolis didn't become a well-organized city immediately. You know, the employers fought. And the whole national trend of the American employer after 1934 up until as late as 1937 in Little Steel.
But wouldn't you agree that it was because of the strike that Minneapolis could then become more unionized?
Oh, yes, granted, uh-huh. granted. But it didn't say... I don't want to leave the impression with anyone that we settled the strike on X day in August, and the following day, X plus one, Minneapolis became a anti-union open shop city to a bastion of union democracy where all employers were lined up.
Yeah. Well, I think
there was
yeah.
a transition period in there that was difficult, and without the leadership of the Minneapolis drivers, it wouldn't have happened either.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess my point is that must have been, that was foreseeable by the Union. The Union knew that if they won this struggle, that the first of many, many steps to be taken, you know, would have been accomplished.
That's right.
And
that certain of the members of the Union did that, the leadership.
Uh-huh.
And it is certainly that.
Don't you think that the Citizens Alliance battled as hard as it did because they understood that inevitability as well?
Oh, they knew it well. They knew how they come into power.
Mm-hmm.
All these Citizens Alliances and the American plan, not all of them, that wasn't their first concept.
Mm-hmm.
But those were the contemporary people. Now, history shows that there's been a long series of degradation against working people.
Mm-hmm.
People have been... Well, we don't have to go into world history. You're more knowledgeable about that probably than I am.
No, I don't think so.
But you see the things that have happened over the years with the colonial rules and the terrible things that have been hoisted on people here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But the contemporaries that were around in Minneapolis in the Citizens Alliance, I think it was A.W. Strong that was the head of the, he was from the Strong Scott Manufacturing Company. I think he was a titular head of the thing then. And they were imbued in their form of monarchy. They thought they had a monarchy. Mm-hmm. And the American plan and the breaking up of the 1921-22 period, the wave of post-war strikes, the defeats of the Union, they knew what was coming. And they were imbued with their theory that, by God, they were going to prevail. And they were going to keep things as they wanted them. It wasn't just a chance happening that Minneapolis, where there were a lot of ethnic people that come from advanced countries, they were not, and I don't mean to speak down to anyone, but the people that come from Sweden, from Norway, from Germany, that composed many of the people, the background of American, I mean of Minnesota citizens, come from countries that were not under the same pattern of the Balkan countries, the Southern European countries that come along later. And they had established the farm labor form of government. And here's Minneapolis, and probably what should have been, ideally, if we're going to look at it from that respect, the pinnacle of that kind of thinking was probably one of the worst cities in the United States. And it had been made that way by the power of the Citizens Alliance and by the role of the government in the Red Hunts, the persecution of Eugene Debs, his jail. They understood what they were going and where they were coming from. I'm convinced of that. And they didn't want to lose that grip. Now, I may sound like a soapboxer, but that's the way it appeared to me. They knew very well what they had in Minneapolis. Absolute control of the city. They had a dukedom there, whatever you want to call it. It was a monarchy. They run the show, just like there was a cult that run Omaha, you know. They had almost the king and the queen over there. They call it Exarban. That's Nebraska spelled backward is what it meant.
Oh.
That's how Exarban comes. It's Nebraska spelled backwards. See, I spent some time in Omaha organizing the area committee activities, so I'm well aware of what happened in Omaha. And they had the same kind of a cult. They were cults. That's some good reading if you want to read into that social structure that was around Omaha, where they had law that you couldn't picket. We broke that, too. We defied them and beat it in 38. But,
Well, would you say that the victory won by the Union was a major one?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
It was not only major, it was a fundamental demonstration of what unions could do if they were properly led and didn't get carried away by a lot of jingoism.
Uh-huh. Well, do you think that that Roosevelt and those other people who were the powers and the higher-ups had any idea that the reason I'm asking this is because it sounds as though you were saying that in a way Roosevelt was taking actions on the basis of mere political opportunism in order to save face, and that in order to quash worker dissatisfaction, he was attempting to appease workers in the city of Minneapolis by somehow making the strike settlement come about and forcing employers to step back a little bit.
Oh, I think he done that. I can speculate. Because when Donahue come to town and advised the Citizens Alliance. Now, of course, there was something else. the Citizens Alliance was finding for the first time a weakening in their own structure. The employers that they had held tight control on were threatening to leave the thing and get back to work and forget this goddamn thing. It ain't all that bad. And there were some of the market firms and a couple of other companies, and I think we spoke about this once before, and certainly the Organizer carried those stories. That was our paper, the Organizer. And perhaps the Daily Press did. But they were also aware that they probably, for the first time, were faced with growing pains in their own ranks. Because their control of the money and financing and their emphasis and power in the banks, they were able to make a lot of people believers that probably didn't feel that in their heart. You know, there were some employers that probably didn't feel all that bad, as the Citizens Alliance did, on their relation to their employees. I say probably. It's likely for me to believe that. But the Citizens Alliance held them in check. If you become if you abscond here, we'll hound you out, you'll get no credit, nobody will do business with you, we'll put you on the do not patronize list and all of that. And modern business cannot survive. We see it today right in the home market. Cars, everything, every credit union in the country is screaming and hollering. Well, it was that way in Minneapolis. They controlled the money, the pressure, and the whole bit. Guy's got a business, he's worked hard to get it together or inherited it or whatever, how he got it. And now he's told that, well, you go that way, why, we'll just put you out of business. You can't make it on your own. And particularly in the market section where they needed money, I suppose, at times to buy consignments of produce in order to make a dollar. Things are altogether different in the produce industry and the market industry today than they were 50 years ago.
Oh, I'm sure.
And the big people, they held the purse strings, and they forced these people, in my opinion, into some sort of submission. Not all of them. Some of them, boy, they had the bit in their teeth, and they were number one rednecks, you know. And they knew what they'd done in 21. They saw the devastation that happened in the Attorney Mitchell General Palmer, whatever Attorney General Mitchell Palmer. They saw the fights against the IWWs. And they beat the railroad strikers and all that mass of post-war strikes. They knew what they could do. And the problem was that in Minneapolis, they hooked on to a bunch of guys that also knew all about this and had spent their life analyzing it. And now we're giving them cards and spades right back. And I would not say that the strike in Minneapolis could have ever have been accomplished if it wouldn't have been for Ray Dunn and Carl Skoglund and their background and their training.
So it sounds as though what you are saying is that had the leadership as well as the rank and file been less perseverant, if they'd withdrawn a month earlier even, or began to lose faith that they could win, that things would have been very, very different.
Oh, certainly. Oh, boy. No, it just wouldn't have been, that's all. And Roosevelt couldn't stand this either. Now, Carl and Ray analyze it. We says, the guy we have to go here, Carl told me on more than one occasion that he felt, and I don't want to think that I'm just real vindictive against Olson. We're analyzing this thing cold-bloodedly.
That's right.
You for the purpose of writing down historical happenings.
Right.
And me, I'm relating it the way that I lived it.
Right.
And Carl pointed out to me that the complete facade of what appeared to be Governor Olson's role in this.
Uh-huh.
And he said, as long as we keep Olson out in front where he can't do anything, we can win. But if we let Olson ever get control of this, we're down, because he's going to subordinate the Farm Labor Party and everything else to the political fortunes of Floyd Olson. Now, that was long before we went on strike. That was right after the settling of the coal strike. And I had a long talk one night with Carl. I was drinking then, and we were having a few belts in a bar, and we were talking. And Carl was a tremendous person to talk to. And he explained to me the whole thing, so I kind of went into that thing with my eyes more open than maybe lots of the other. I was fortunate.
Sure.
But Olson, of course, was a smaller edition of Roosevelt. And Carl had analyzed strikes. He'd been knocked out of the ball game, and he was a mechanic for Pullman. He lost out in a 21 strike, the shopman strike. And he knew he'd lived through this stuff. And so did Ray Dunn. And Ray Rainbow. But Ray wasn't in no way the political thinkers that Carl and Scogie were. Ray was just one of the persons employed in the driving industry that fell victim to the Red Hunts, but to that reactionary thing that went on in the 24 period.
Uh-huh. Let me switch the tape.
All right. I'll get my water then.
All right.